Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 43.
Guanyin, the Bodhisattva.
She first chanted a spell.
Okay, a spell.
Yeah.
You know, linked to these rings. And it caused
Red Boy, the demon,
some pain, real agony, it sounds like, at first.
Agony, right.
But, and what was really striking is how the rings weren't just on him. The source uses the phrase sa.
Usap, meaning?
Meaning they rooted themselves into his flesh.
Pretty intense.
It is. And the text adds, the more he struggled, tried to pull them off.
The more it hurt.
Exactly. The pain came back worse. So it's a physical bind, but one that uses his own resistance against him.
Clever. An inescapable, painful restraint then.
Definitely. But even with these rings literally, you know, part of him.
He wasn't done.
Not quite. The text says he still had his wild spirit wasn't settled. He gets angry, actually attacks Sun Wukong again with his spear.
Right. Which brings us to this really interesting combination of methods. So Wukong tells Guanyin, chant the spell again.
Yeah, he urges her to. But she doesn't. The source says she does something completely different.
What's that?
She uses her willow branch, dips it in this sweet dew,
okay,
sprinkles it, and just calls out, which means close.
According to the text.
It's remarkable, really.
Yeah.
Instantly, Red Boy drops his spear. His hands just snap together.
Snap together.
Yeah, in front of his chest, locked tight, hands clasped on his chest, couldn't open them again.
Wow. So a very specific, almost symbolic posture. And the source calls this the Yi.
The Guanyin twist, exactly.
A kind of magical binding that forces his own hands together. It's not external pressure. It's locking his own body.
Precisely. And it's this combination. You've got the inescapable rings rooted in him, plus this magical Guanyin twist binding his hands.
That's what finally does it.
That's what the text says finally made him realize the depth of her power. Only then does he truly submit. It describes him bowing his head down.
So the text really shows that the initial physical rings weren't quite enough on their own. It took this, well, unique magical command, this posture lock, to break his active resistance.
Got that actual submission, yeah.
But the story doesn't stop quite there, does it? The sources seem to indicate that even after bowing, he was still considered, you know, wild at heart.
That's a really important point. Subdual wasn't the end goal. Transformation was. Guanyin didn't just say, okay, you bowed, we're good.
Right. What did the text say she did next to really sort of integrate him?
Well, she gives him this incredibly demanding task, a pilgrimage.
A pilgrimage.
Yeah, all the way back to her place, Mount Luyia. But he has to do it step by step, bowing with every single step.
Wow, step by step, bowing each time. That's a lot.
It is. The source calls it the 53 stages or bows of the pilgrimage. And it wasn't like optional.
A requirement.
Absolutely. A requirement before she would fully, truly receive him, complete his, you know, acceptance.
So it's this fascinating progression laid out in the text.
Totally. You go from inescapable physical restraint with the rings.
Right. Turning his strength against him.
To precise magical control of his body with the twist.
Leading to that initial submission.
And finally, this mandated, really arduous journey designed for internal change, for repentance.
And the text confirms he does it. He completes this.
It does. It says he eventually finished it and returned to the right path, achieved an enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
So while Guanyin is managing this, what's happening with the rest of the pilgrim team? Sandy, Monkey, Pigsy.
Well, Sandy, as you might expect, has been waiting rather impatiently back in the forest.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Monkey returns, you know, full of relief, finds Sandy and explains that the Bodhisattva was called and the monster is subdued. Naturally, he emphasizes Guanyin's immense power.
Of course he does. Right. And they waste no time. They head straight back to the cave. The text says there.
Which implies a pretty direct arrival, maybe forceful.
Could be. They quickly clear out any remaining minor demons for he.
And the immediate priority is freeing Pigsy.
Right. Poor Pigsy, who'd been captured and stuffed into that binding sack.
Yeah. So, and then they find their master, Tripitaka, still in a rather vulnerable state.
How so?
Terrell. Completely naked and bound in the courtyard, and the text notes he's understandably crying.
Oh, the poor master. Naked and crying. Rough time.
Definitely. They quickly release him, help him get dressed, and express their sympathy, saying,
Master, you've suffered, which he clearly has.
Tripitaka is, of course, grateful and immediately asks, you know, how the demon was finally overcome.
So Monkey gets to tell the story again.
And so Monkey recounts the story again, detailing how he summoned Guanyin and how the was subdued. Tripitaka's reaction upon hearing it was, the Bodhisattva is immediate, isn't it? Mm. Very reverent.
Oh, yes. He kneels down right away and bows towards the south to offer his thanks to Guanyin.
But Monkey then offers this classic monkey perspective.
He does indeed. He tells Tripitaka they don't need to thank Guanyin. In fact, he says it's Situ Watowai.
Which means?
It means, basically, it's they who did her a favor by helping her gain an attendant the very same scene they just helped subdue and send on his bowing pilgrimage.
Wow.
And he links this again to the Wajam. Does that strike you as a bit boastful, coming from someone who literally just needed divine rescue?
It does seem a bit audacious. Is it just Monkey being Monkey, you know, his usual self? Or is there maybe a deeper layer? Perhaps him recognizing that their struggle actually facilitated this step in the Weishan process.
Yeah, like making them participants in a larger karmic unfolding. It could be both, couldn't it? It has that characteristic monkey swagger, for sure. But it's framed within this genuine Buddhist concept. It suggests their trials aren't just about their salvation, but contribute to the spiritual path of others, too.
That really reframes the dynamic. They're not just passive recipients of aid, but maybe active agents in a larger cosmic journey.
Mm-hmm. After that rather profound moment, though, they turn to the more immediate practical matters.
Right, like getting some supplies.
Exactly. They gather any valuables left in the cave, find some food, prepare a meal, and make sure Tripitaka is properly fed and recovering.
Good. So with the immediate crisis passed and their needs met, the master and disciples get back on the road, continuing their journey westward, steadfast in their purpose.
Some time passes after this incident. The text notes they travel for...
Over a month.
Over a month has gone by since the last major event, so they've put some distance between themselves and that trial.
But then, suddenly they hear a sound, a very loud, striking water sound. It's jarring and immediate.
And this sound instantly startles Tripitaka Hiao.
Tripitaka, ever prone to anxiety on this difficult path, expresses his fear and asks, you know, where this unsettling sound is coming from.
And Monkey, perhaps a little weary of the master's constant fear,
yeah,
teases him mercilessly. He calls him, oop.
Far too overly suspicious.
Pretty much. And says he's not fit to be a monk if he's so easily startled. Then he throws out a spiritual challenge, asking if Tripitaka has forgotten the Heart Sutra.
Ah, the Heart Sutra. A foundational Mahayana Buddhist text. That's a big challenge.
It is. Tripitaka quickly defends himself, clarifying that he learned the Heart Sutra orally from Master Wu Chao back on Futu Mountain.
Okay.
And that he constantly recites its 54 lines, 270 characters. He feels he knows it by heart and challenges Monkey to name the specific line he's supposedly forgotten.
And here is where a fundamental spiritual teaching is presented through this interaction, isn't it? Monkey doesn't say Tripitaka has forgotten the words.
Exactly. But that he's forgotten the meaning in practice, he points to the line, zir.
Without eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind.
Precisely. Monkey explains the core concept behind this line in the context of spiritual cultivation. For those who have renounced worldly attachments, for those on a spiritual path like theirs, the senses, the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and consciousness or mind should not be allowed to become attached to external stimuli. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, physical sensations, thoughts.
Right, the external world.
When they are uncontrolled and chase after or are disturbed by external things, he calls them the you.
The six thieves. Thieves that steal your peace or distract you from the path.
Exactly that. And Monkey directly connects this teaching back to Tripitaka's current state and his struggles throughout the journey.
How so?
He points out that Tripitaka's anxieties and desires, his fear of demons, his worries about food, his reactions to smells and tastes, being startled by sounds like the river, his fixation on various things, were all symptoms of these Oryu, these six thieves, causing disturbance within him.
Ah.
And the crucial insight Monkey offers is that these internal attachments and reactions are actually preventing him from truly reaching the West, from truly seeing the Buddha. That requires transcending these sensory distractions.
So the journey isn't just about reaching a physical place.
It's about conquering the internal landscape, too.
Wow. That's a powerful moment of self-reflection delivered by Monkey, surprisingly. How does Tripitaka react to that, well, pretty direct feedback?
He becomes silent for a while. The text says, Adusha, deeply contemplating Monkey's words.
Okay.
Then in response, he recites this poignant poem that gives voice to the very raw human struggle of the pilgrimage.
A poem. What does it say?
He speaks of the constant travel, day and night, the physical hardship, worn-out straw shoes, battered bamboo hats.
You can feel the exhaustion.
Definitely. He talks about the difficult, even mournful sights and sounds at night. The monkey cries are lamentable, the bird squawks unbearable.
Mm.
And he expresses his deep longing for the journey, which likely refers to the latter stages to finally end so he can obtain the scriptures. Shineyo yu.
You really feel the weight of his human struggle here, the exhaustion, maybe homesickness underneath the spiritual quest. How do his disciples respond to this expression of vulnerability?
Well, they react in their characteristic ways. Monkey just laughs, recognizing it as simple homesickness.
Yes, homesickness.
That's how Monkey sees it. But he offers a reassuring, slightly detached perspective that success will come with effort. Work hard, and it'll happen.
And Pigsy.
Pigsy, predictable as ever, just complains about the difficulty. The demonic obstacles are fierce and high. He suggests it might literally take 1,000 years to get through it all.
1,000 years. Always the optimist.
Right. And Sandy, in contrast, quietly tells Pigsy that they are both ees.
Clumsy-mouthed and dull.
Basically, yeah. Meaning they shouldn't waste time complaining or questioning. They should just keep persevering.
Shoulder to shoulder, carrying their burdens.
Success will eventually be theirs. It's a beautiful summary of his patient, steadfast nature. Just keep going.
So they're discussing internal struggles, different ways of coping with hardship, still moving forward. And while they're talking, while the horse's hooves are still clip-clopping, they reach the source of the sound, a massive river blocking their path. The horse can't possibly cross it.
And the text provides a really striking, almost unsettling description of this. Yis, the Blackwater River.
How is it described?
It has jik-ji-cha-gu-do, layered thick waves and piled turbid ripples. It looks like tom, black muck, and black oil.
Black muck and black oil. Sounds nasty.
It's not just dark. It seems unnatural. Up close, it doesn't reflect their figures at all.
No reflection. Weird.
And looking across, you can't even see trees on the far bank. It's described with phrases like, du'i, a land of ink and 1,000 live of ash.
Ink and ash.
The water foam looked like sick piled charcoal, and the waves like, ooh, turning coal.
Wow. That is incredibly vivid and strange.
This strangeness affects even the natural world around it. Animals avoid it.
Right, why?
Because they dislike how deep and black it is and fear how vast and boundless it seems.
Yeah. In stark contrast to this alien-looking, unsettling water, the banks are described as vibrant and full of life.
Exactly. The reeds and grass on the banks are lush green, and the flowers on the sandbar are competing in their bright, splendid colors.
Such a sharp contrast.
And the text wraps up this description with a rhetorical question that really emphasizes just how bizarre and out of place this river is.
What's the question?
Lakes, rivers, streams are everywhere. Meeting places exist for all.
But who has ever seen a Western Blackwater River? It's presented as something unique, perhaps even anomalous, on this specific path.
Naturally, Tripitaka, needing a practical explanation, asks why the water is so black.
And Pigsy, ever the comic relief, immediately jokes that someone spilled a dye vat.
Huh.
Okay. Sandy, joining in, jokes that someone was washing inkstones, Pacey.
Hmm. They're quite the pair.
But Monkey quickly brings them back to the core problem. Jokes aside, how are they going to get Tripitaka across this strange black river? And this, again, highlights the fundamental challenge of their group dynamic, doesn't it?
It really does. Pigsy and Sandy state they could easily cross themselves by flying on clouds or swimming. They could do it in moments.
Right.
But the difficulty, they say, is it's just the master who is the problem. He's mortal.
Tripitaka asks how wide it is. Pigsy gives an estimate.
Yeah, Tripitaka. Around 10 wide. And then Tripitaka asks the obvious question. Which of them will carry him across?
Monkey suggests Pigsy, right, given his strength and, you know, aquatic background with water.
Makes sense. But Pigsy gives a firm refusal, citing specific reasons straight from the text.
Oh, what reasons?
He explains that carrying a mortal like Tripitaka makes him
as heavy as a mountain.
Exactly. If he tried to fly with him, he couldn't even get 3 feet off the ground.
Oh.
And if he tried to swim while carrying him, Tripitaka's sheer mortal weight would simply drag him down into the water. Just another obstacle.
Standard problem, really. How do you cross?
And then, almost, well, too conveniently, this little boat shows up upstream, just one guy rowing it.
You'd think, great, perfect timing.
And they do. The disciples call out, you know, asking for a ride. They mention that whole convenience thing, or like, help us out, we're on important business.
Makes sense.
But the boatman, he rows over and says, well, his boat's tiny, like carved from one log, maybe fits two people max.
A limitation.
Yeah. And this is where Pigsy kind of sees his chance, always looking for the easy way out.
Right? Pigsy.
He suggests that he and the master, Tripitaka, should go first, claims he's too lazy to wait around.
Uh-huh. And tells Sandy and Monkey to just, what, guard the luggage?
Watch the stuff, watch the horse. And surprisingly, Monkey actually agrees to it.
Okay, so Pigsy and Tripitaka hop in this little boat with the boatman. They push off.
And then, like, almost immediately, things get wild. They're not even halfway across.
And the river just erupts.
Totally erupts. The source describes it so vividly, like, bam, cannon clouds overhead, black waves surging up, sand flying everywhere, blinding the sun.
Trees crashing down. Sounds terrifying.
Oh, it's pure chaos. The description says it shakes mountains, makes everything panic. Definitely not your average storm.
It feels unnatural.
Because it is. This wasn't weather. It turns out the storm was created, conjured up by the boatman.
The boatman did it. So
he's a monster revealed right then and there.
Oh, wow.
And in all that chaos, he whipped up Tripitaka and Pigsy and the boat itself. They're just swallowed by the water.
Gone.
Vanished. Without a trace.
Man. So back on the bank, Sandy and Monkey must be freaking out.
Absolutely reeling. Their master, their fellow disciple, just disappeared into the churning river.
What do they even think happened?
Well, Sandy's first thought is kind of logical. Maybe the storm just, you know, flipped the boat, capsized it.
Right. So search downstream.
That's what he suggests. Hope they wash ashore somewhere.
But Monkey, he usually senses this stuff, doesn't he?
He does. He immediately smells a rat. Or, well, a demon in this case. He points out the boatman seemed kind of unrighteous summa right from the start.
Had a bad vibe.
Exactly. And Monkey figures this creature made the storm happen specifically to drag the master underwater.
Okay, so foul play suspected.
Definitely. And hearing this, Sandy, who's, you know, pretty comfortable in water after his flowing sand river days.
Right, he used to be a river monster himself.
Well, yeah, so he volunteers, says, I'll go in, I'll search underwater. He gets ready, takes off his outer robe, ties up his clothes.
Okay, so Sandy dives in. He's got his big staff, the monster-quelling staff.
And his lean red, yep. And he just starts walking along the riverbed.
And then, does he find anything?
Pretty quickly, actually. As he's moving through the depths, he starts to hear voices. Talking.
A clue.
A huge clue. So he finds a spot to hide and watch.
Mm.
And he sees this whole underwater building, like a residence.
What kind?
It's got a main gate, and there's writing across it.
Oh, no.
Which means Hanging Valley Black River, River God's Residence. So it is the River God's place.
That's what it says. But as Sandy listens in to the conversation happening inside.
It's not the River God.
Nope. It's the monster, the boatman. And he's basically laying out his whole plan loud and clear.
Oh, this is where we find out why he did it.
Exactly. And the motive is, well, it's famous, but still chilling. He refers to Tripitaka as this incredibly pure person, someone who's cultivated virtue for 10 lifetimes.
And eating his flesh.
Grants immortality. The monster says he's been waiting ages for this chance.
Yikes. Okay, so that's the why. What's the how?
Well, this is where it gets weirdly specific and kind of gruesome. He's telling his minions, his little ones, correct, to get these iron cages ready.
Cages? For what?
To steam Tripitaka and Pigsy and get this whole...
Steam them whole. Like, no prep. Just straight into the steamer.
Apparently. It's a... darkly practical, maybe.
Or just monstrously lazy. And then what?
As if that wasn't enough, he's planning a dinner party.
You're kidding.
Nope. He's going to send out invitations to invite his second uncle over for a warm birthday celebration.
A birthday party. Featuring steamed monk and pig.
That seems to be the menu.
Okay, Sandy overhears all this. He must be absolutely furious.
Totally enraged. He can't just hide anymore. He bursts out.
What does he do?
Slams his staff right into the gate, starts yelling, demanding they return the master and Pigsy. Now.
That's going to cause a stir.
Oh, yeah. The little demons, they scramble inside, yelling that someone's attacking the gate. They report it to the boss.
The old monster.
And he gears up, puts on his armor, grabs his weapon.
Which is
a pretty unique one, a bamboo joint steel whip.
Okay. So the monster comes out. What does he look like? We know he's a monster, but...
The source gives us a good look. Square face, round eyes shining like clouds, curled lips, huge red mouth like a blood basin.
That sounds charming.
Sparse whiskers, like iron wires, messy red hair, like a fierce, angry spirit. And we find out his true form. He's a little alligator dragon.
An alligator dragon. Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense for a river monster.
Right. And he comes out, starts trash-talking Sandy immediately, basically confirms, yeah, I got him. Gonna steam him.
And then he throws down a challenge.
Yeah. Yep. Says, let's fight. You win 3 rounds, you can have him back. You lose.
You get steamed too.
Pretty much. Join the party.
High stakes. So the fight starts.
Right there, underwater. Sandy with his staff, the alligator dragon with his bamboo joint whip. Izun versus Yu.
It must be quite a battle.
The source frames it really well. It's this thousand-year-old monster fighting for immortality versus, you know, Sandy, this former celestial guard fighting to save his master's life.
Immortality versus salvation.
Exactly. They go at it back and forth for about 30 rounds.
30 rounds? Does anyone get the upper hand?
Nope. It's a stalemate. Neither one can really beat the other down there.
So Sandy realizes.
Oh, what? He realizes he probably can't win this alone. Not here. Not underwater in the monster's home turf. He needs help.
He needs Monkey.
Definitely. So he needs a plan to get the fight out of the water.
How does he manage that?
He pulls a classic move, feigns defeat,
sea
gun, pretends he's losing, turns and retreats, swimming back up.
Hoping the monster will chase him.
That's the idea. Lure him out into the open for Monkey.
Does it work?
No. The alligator dragon is smarter than that. He doesn't take the bait.
Really? Why not?
He actually shouts after Sandy that he can't be bothered chasing him because he's got invitations to write for his uncle's birthday party.
Seriously. He stops fighting to plan a party.
Priorities, I guess. Or maybe just an excuse not to leave his lair.
So Sandy gets back to the surface, alone.
Yeah, he emerges from the water. Frustrated, probably, but he's got crucial intel.
He tells Monkey everything.
Everything. The name on the gate, the horrifying steaming plan, the weird detail about inviting the uncle, the fight itself.
Describes the monster like a big turtle or alligator dragon.
Right. Fighting for 30 rounds and how the monster wouldn't follow him out.
So they're standing there trying to figure out what to do next. Like, who's this guy? Who's the uncle?
And just as they're talking, something else happens. Another arrival.
Don't tell me another monster.
Almost the opposite. An old man appears downstream. He comes up, kneels down, and says he's the real Black River God.
The real one. Monkey must be suspicious.
Immediately. He's like, hold on. Didn't we just deal with an imposter? Is this you again trying another trick?
Fair question.
But the old man seems genuinely distraught. He's crying, explaining, no, he's the real god. The monster, the little alligator dragon, Jong, he's an imposter.
Where did the monster come from?
According to the real river god, the alligator dragon showed up just last year, came from the Western Sea.
And just took over.
Fought the real river god, beat him, and kicked him out of his own residence that Chintal started messing with all the local water folk, too.
So what did the real god do? Did he report it?
He did. He went to the big boss of that region, the West Sea Dragon King, Beifol, filed a complaint.
Okay, hoping for justice.
But here's the kicker. Remember the monster wanting to invite his second uncle?
Yeah.
The West Sea Dragon King is the uncle, the monster's maternal uncle.
You're kidding. So the Dragon King.
He basically told the real river god, tough luck, let my nephew have the place. Dismiss the whole thing. Corruption.
Wow. So the system is rigged because of family ties.
Exactly. And the poor river god couldn't go any higher, couldn't appeal to the Jabe Emperor Day because his divine rank was too low. He was totally stuck.
Powerless against the monster and his powerful protective uncle.
Right. So hearing that Monkey, the great sage equaling heaven, was in the area, that was his last hope. He came asking Monkey for help, for vengeance, because the official channels failed him.
Okay, now it all clicks into place for Monkey.
Totally. The monster's party invitation wasn't just random, it was the key. The uncle is the reason the monster is getting away with this.
So Monkey sees the connection and the leverage.
His mind just goes straight to the solution. It's bold.
What's the plan? Fight the Dragon King.
Essentially, yes. Go straight to the source of the protection. His plan is fly over to the Western Sea, confront and capture the Dragon King first.
Capture the uncle.
Capture the uncle, then force the uncle to deal with his own nephew. Make him responsible for getting the monster to release Tripitaka and Pigsy.
That's actually really clever. Use the family connection against them.
Exactly. So he tells the real river god, okay, you wait here with Sandy, watch the luggage, I'm off to the sea.
And the river god must be overjoyed.
Immensely grateful. Finally, a chance for justice.
So Monkey, he doesn't just like fly over and look around. He goes straight for the West Sea and dives in.
Using that water avoidance spell.
That's the one. Lets him operate underwater like he's on dry land. It's his usual method for dealing with, well, watery situations.
And almost the second he's underwater, bam, he runs right into someone or something.
Yeah, a blackfish spirit. Not the main guy, not too long, just sort of a messenger.
And Wukong, no questions asked, apparently.
Nope. The text is pretty blunt. Wukong's focused. He just hits it with his staff. Kills it instantly. Swift. Brutal, maybe, but efficient.
And taking down this fish messenger leads to the big break, right? What was it carrying?
It was carrying this box. A golden request box. Fancy. And inside.
A letter. Ha-ha. And this is where it all unravels.
The smoking gun. Or I guess the dripping wet gun. Huh, exactly. The letter names names. It's from Sutyu, foolish nephew Tuoji. That's our monster, the Tuolong.
Tuoji, okay. And who's he writing to?
He's writing to his Hutyuo, his second uncle, the elder Ao.
So the monster is the nephew writing to his uncle. And what's in the letter? Just, hi, uncle.
Not quite. He starts by thanking his uncle, you know, for past kindness. Standard polite stuff.
Okay.
But then he drops the bombshell. He said he's captured Hurry two things, two people, and he calls them Toothyu.
Rare in the world. That's got to be the Tang monk. Maybe Baji or someone.
Definitely the monk. And get this. He's captured them because his uncle's birthday, his Enki, is coming up. He's throwing a feast, a Torang, and wants his uncle to come celebrate.
Wait, he kidnapped the Tang monk as a birthday present or like the main course?
It seems that way. And he's inviting the uncle over for the party. Wukong intercepts the invitation.
That's incredible. The source even says Wukong finds it funny, right? Like, the villain just mailed him the confession.
Exactly. It's a huge stroke of luck. And it totally changes Wukong's plan. This isn't just some random river demon. This involves, potentially, a Dragon King.
So, straight to the source. West Sea Dragon King's Crystal Palace.
Right. He gets announced. The Dragon King, Ao Shen, comes out. He's all respectful, you know, great sage, this and that.
But Wukong cuts right through it. His opening line is amazing. Something like, you've already eaten my wine, right?
Yeah, basically accusing him straight up. You're already benefiting from this, or you're in on this somehow. It's bold.
And how does the Dragon King react, especially when Wukong presumably shows him the letter?
Oh, he completely loses it. The text says, soul scattered, utter terror, drops to his knees, begging forgiveness.
Wow. Okay, so maybe not totally ignorant of his nephew's activities.
Well, that's what Wukong likely thinks.
Yeah.
And this terror leads to the big explanation, the family history dump.
Okay, lay it on us. Who is this Tuolong, really?
Ao Shen explains. Tuolong is his own sister's ninth son.
Ninth son, okay. And the father.
Ah, this is where it connects to past events. The father was the Jing River Dragon King.
The Jing River Dragon King, the one who messed with the rain totals and got executed by Wai Zheng in a dream.
That's him. A major figure executed for defying heaven.
Yeah.
So Tuolong's dad is this famous, disgraced Dragon King.
Whoa, okay, so the backstory is intense.
Right. So after the execution, Ao Shen's sister was widowed. Nine kids, nowhere to go. He took her and the nephews in, did the uncle thing, helped raise them.
A supportive brother.
Seems so. But then, he says the sister died just 2 years ago. Tuolong, being the ninth and youngest, was still, well, young.
Needed looking after.
Exactly. And apparently needed a place to cultivate himself. So just last year, Ao Shen placed him in the Blackwater River. Temporarily, he claims, intending to move him later.
And he claims he had no idea his nephew was, you know, kidnapping holy monks, doing these wicked deeds.
That's his story. The Tuolong was meant to be quietly cultivating, not causing mayhem. He's essentially pleading ignorance about the extent of the trouble. It's the nephew's fault, basically.
Okay, this is messy. But then Wukong asks a really interesting question, doesn't he, about the brothers?
He does. He looks at this situation One dad, the Jing River Dragon King, and 9 sons, who are apparently very different. He asked Aoshun how his sister managed to have several different kinds of offspring with just one husband.
It's a bit blunt, but a fair question if they're all dragons, but maybe look or act differently.
And Aoshun gives the classic answer. You hear this reference a lot. He says, Kai.
Dragon gives birth to 9 kinds, and the 9 kinds are all different.
Exactly. It's the fundamental explanation for diversity within dragon families in this mythology. Same parents, very different kids. It's just how dragons work.
And then he lists them, right? The other 8 brothers. It's quite a roll call.
It really is, and it perfectly illustrates that saying.
Let's see. Who are they? Where are they?
Okay, so the first son, the little yellow dragon, he's at the Huai River. The second little black dragon is at the Ji River. Third, greenback dragon, holds the Jiang River. Fourth, red-whiskered dragon, guards the He River. So 4 brothers managing major rivers.
Standard dragon stuff, maybe?
Sort of. But then it gets wild. The 5th brother, the Shi, lazy dragon, he rings the bell for the Buddha.
For the Buddha, wow. Okay.
6th, the Yi, stable beast dragon, guards the ridges on divine palaces. 7th, the Ilie, guards those huge ornamental pillars, the Yi, for the Jade Emperor himself.
Okay, so serving Buddha, guarding heavenly palaces.
8th, the Yu, clam dragon, is apparently with the eldest brother, supporting the great peaks.
Supporting mountains.
And then 9th is Tualong, the youngest, sent to the Blackwater River last year to, quote, cultivate.
What a spread. River guardians, celestial servants, mountain props, and then the little brother causing chaos in a minor river. That 9 kinds thing really covers it.
It absolutely does. It provides the whole context. It explains why one son might be a troublemaker, while his siblings have these incredibly high-status, important jobs throughout the cosmos. It's inherent in their dragon nature.
So Wukong hears all this, the tragic backstory, the uncle trying to help, the inherent diversity of dragons, the claim of ignorance. How does he react to Aoshun now?
He seems to accept the explanation, or at least parts of it. He decides not to report the West Sea Dragon King to the Jade Emperor. He kind of chalks it up to the nephew being young, ignorant, and acting out without the Unker's direct orders for this specific crime.
So leniency for the Dragon King.
Yes, but with a very firm condition. No just letting it slide.
What's the demand?
Wukong insists Aoshun immediately send forces to capture Tualong and, most importantly, rescue his master. Take responsibility for your family, essentially.
And does he?
Instantly. Aoshun orders his own son, the crown prince Moang, to lead 500 shrimp and fish strong soldiers, Chervin, to go apprehend cousin Tualong.
Prince Moang leading the shrimp soldiers. Love it.
It's quite the image. Aoshun, probably relieved, offers Wukong a feast. But Wukong's like, no time. Gotta save the master.
Focused.
Totally. He just has a quick cup of tea, offered by the Dragon King's daughter, a dragon princess. And then he heads out with Prince Moang and the aquatic troops.
Back to the Blackwater River.
Exactly. When they arrive, Wukong hops ashore. He decides to let Prince Moang handle the actual capture. It's dragon family business now. Let the cousin deal with the cousin.
And who's waiting on the bank?
Shaw Monk and the River Giety, who've been, you know, pacing anxiously the whole time.
So Wukong gets to tell the whole wild story.
Pretty much. Okay, guys. So I dived in, killed a fish, found this letter, went to the West Sea, accused the Dragon King, got this insane family history lesson involving an executed dad and 9 different brothers, and now the Dragon King's son is here with an army to get the master back.
Must have been quite the debrief. How does Shaw Monk take it?
Oh, huge relief.
Yeah.
Just happy that there's a plan and the master is hopefully about to be rescued.
So they just...
Yep. They wait on the riverbank. The mystery solved, the connections made, and the rescue mission, led by a dragon prince, is underway. From the demon's perspective, he's got the Tang Monk, he's got Pig Baji, and his intention. Pretty simple, really. Classic demon stuff.
Wants to eat them, right.
Yep. He wants to eat the Tang Monk specifically because he thinks that eating someone who's cultivated for 10 lifetimes...
Right.
Well, that grants longevity.
Right, the ultimate prize. And his plan isn't just, you know, a quiet meal for one. He actually decides to invite his second uncle, the West Sea Dragon King, to join in.
How generous.
He sends a messenger fish, the text calls it, carrying a formal invitation over to the West Sea.
But here's the first, like, major twist. Instead of the uncle showing up, maybe rubbing his hands together.
Ah, yeah, ready for the feast.
The surprise arrival is his cousin, Prince Moang. As the text puts it, and... he definitely does not arrive ready for a banquet.
No, not at all. Moang shows up, and he's got troops with him. described as Hoang, or Lean Sea Soldiers, and they immediately set up camp right outside the demon's underwater place.
Plus, he's wearing armor. And carrying a weapon.
Exactly. Which, you know, if you're the demon expecting a family dinner, that's got to be incredibly suspicious.
What's going through his head, seeing his cousin roll up with an army?
Well, the text makes it pretty clear he suspects foul play immediately. You just don't bring soldiers to a family feast, right? Even with cousins.
Not usually, no.
So he gets his own gear ready, his armor, his weapon, just in case. He greets Moang politely enough, but he's definitely, like, questioning the whole military escort thing.
So the confrontation starts, and the truth comes out pretty fast. Mm-hmm. Moang doesn't beat around the bush.
No, he gets right to it.
And the demon, maybe he's still thinking this is just a misunderstanding. He just lays it all out.
Totally openly. He repeats his plan. Gonna steam and eat the Tang monk's body, the dual body, to warm his uncle's life.
Wow. Warm his uncle's life? That's a phrase.
It's this really twisted kind of filial piety, I guess, trying to extend his uncle's life by sharing this amazing meal. And he mentions, oh, yeah, got Baji too. Gonna eat him as well.
Okay, and this is where Moang's reaction is just crucial and where we see how clueless the demon really is.
Absolutely. Moang calls him extremely foolish.
Yes.
He points out, look, you know the monk is from Tang China going west, but you have no idea who his protectors are.
The demon tries to brush it off, though, right? He mentions fighting Xiao Wujing.
Yeah, he's like, oh, Xiao Wujing beat him yesterday outside. No big deal. He clearly thinks that's the extent of the protection. Big mistake.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The whole power dynamic just flips. Moang drops the bomb.
He does. He reveals the most powerful disciple. Sun Wukong, the great sage equal to heaven.
It's yeah.
The one famous from 500 years back for causing Tai Shi chaos in heaven.
That name alone.
Exactly. That name carries immense weight. And Moang explains that Wukong is now protecting the monk.
Just hearing that name must have sent a chill down the demon's spine.
Moang explains that Sun Wukong intercepted that messenger fish, the one carrying the dinner invitation. And then Wukong went straight to the West Sea Dragon Palace.
Oh, wow.
And accused Moang's father, the West Sea King, Oxun, and Sun, accused them of basically collaborating with demons and kidnapping people.
Held them accountable.
Pretty much. Put the pressure right on them.
So Moang's demand isn't really a request?
Not at all. It's an ultimatum. Release the Tang monk, release Baji, bring them to the riverbank for Sun Wukong. Moang says he'll try to smooth things over, apologize to Wukong. But this is the demon's only shot at survival.
The cousin he invited for dinner is now telling him he's basically toast unless he cooperates with the guy who just threatened his whole family.
You can imagine how well that went down.
Yeah, the demon does not react well, and it's just pure rage, disbelief.
He feels his cousin is protecting outsiders despite their close family ties, the text says, highlighting that direct maternal cousin relationship. He thought that meant something.
He becomes defiant then.
Incredibly defiant. He boasts, like, okay, maybe you're scared of Wukong, Moang, but I'm not.
Oh.
He throws down a challenge directly to Wukong. Fight me. Three rounds, like a quick, decisive fight right here at my gate. If Wukong wins, fine, I'll let the master go.
And if Wukong loses?
Then the demon says he'll capture Wukong too and steam eat all three of them together. No guests, no ceremony, just, you know, dinner.
Wow. Okay, Moang must have been furious.
Oh, yeah. He calls the demon this wicked creature, and he's like, forget waiting for Wukong, you fight me.
And the fight begins.
It does. The text describes this chaotic underwater battle. Moang sea soldiers against the demon's river monsters. Whales, crabs, fish, shrimp. Just a big aquatic brawl.
But Moang is powerful.
Very. Described like a chop of Vajra deity. He uses his three-edged trident, and here's the clever bit, the turning point. He fakes an opening, like he pretends to slip up.
A feint.
Exactly. And the demon, maybe overconfident, maybe desperate, lunges for it. He falls right into the trap.
And Moang takes him down.
Instantly. Hits his arm, makes him stumble, kicks his leg, bam, down he goes.
Yeah.
Moang's soldiers swarm him, tie him up, and then there's that gruesome detail.
The people bone.
Yeah. They pierce his kong, the collarbone area, with an iron chain. It's a way to disable powerful beings in this kind of folklore, stops them using their strength.
So just like that, the boastful demon is captured, dragged out onto the bank before Wukong and Xiao Wujing.
And Wukong lays into him, gives him this whole list of charges.
That kind of things.
Disrespecting the West Sea King, who apparently let him live there in the first place, illegally squatting in the water god's home, acting cruelly, deceiving his superiors, and of course, kidnapping the master and his brother disciple.
Wukong even thinks about hitting him with the staff, right? But holds back.
He does. He considers using his staff, and the text notes it would just kill the demon instantly. It's that heavy, that powerful, but he hesitates. Before he decides, though, he asks the crucial question.
Where's the master?
Exactly. And the demon, faced with Wukong, just completely crumples, starts begging for mercy.
Admits he was foolish.
Totally. I was foolish, didn't know who you were. Thank you for not killing me instantly. And then he quickly offers, untie me, and I'll release the master.
But Moang warns Wukong.
Right. Moang, having just fought and captured him, jumps in like, careful, he's tricky. Don't trust this sudden cooperation.
So they don't untie him. Who goes to get the master then?
Xiao Wujing remembers the way to the water mansion. He volunteers, and he goes with the Black River God, the Ungol, who's obviously happy to get his home back.
Makes sense. What do they find inside?
They go in, the gates are open, place is deserted. The demon's forces must have fled when he was captured. And inside, they find the Tang Monk and Baji.
Still tied up?
Yep, still tied up, naked, sand, just like the demon planned. Grim picture.
So Xiao Wujing frees the master. The river god frees Baji.
They carry them out, back to the riverbank.
And Baji sees the captured demon. I can imagine his reaction.
Oh yeah, pure fury. Sees the guy who's about to steam him, grabs his rake, and just goes for him. Wants payback.
But Wukong stops him. Again.
Yes. Sun Wukong intervenes. Yeah. Tells Baji, hold on, spare his life. And here's the key reason. For the sake of the filial father and son, Ao Shun.
Ah, so it comes back to Moang and his father, the West Sea King.
Exactly. It's that relationship again. The very family Wukong confronted earlier is now the reason the demon gets spared immediate death by Wukong.
That's come. So what happens to the demon now?
Moang steps forward. He thanks Wukong, says he has to leave soon. He confirms he'll take the demon back to his father, the king.
Then the king will punish him.
Moang assures Wukong that even though Wukong spared the death penalty, his father will definitely punish the demon severely. And they'll report back to Wukong about it.
Wukong agrees to that. He trusts the West Sea King to handle it.
Seems so. He agrees and asks Moang to pass on his thanks to his father. Then Moang takes the captured demon, gathers his troops, and heads back towards the West Sea.
And the local deity, the Black River God?
He's just grateful. Thanks Sun Wukong profusely for getting his home back. Order is restored to the Black River, at least for now.
Okay, so the immediate crisis is over. Demon dealt with, master rescued, but there's still one problem.
Right. The Tang Monk points it out. We're still on the east bank. How do we actually cross this river?
Good point. So who helps?
The Black River God steps up. He owes Wukong now, right? He says, don't worry, I'll clear the way.
How does he do that?
It's pretty cool, actually. He uses his water magic. He blocks the river flow upstream and somehow dries up the downstream part, creating a completely dry path right across the riverbed.
Wow. Like Moses parting the Red Sea, but, you know, a river god.
Sort of, yeah. A direct result of Wukong sorting things out. So the whole group crosses on this miraculous dry path.
The Tang Monk on his horse, Baji leading.
Xiao Wujing carrying the luggage, Wukong helping out. They all make it safely to the West Bank.
They thank the river god, obviously.
Profusely, yes. They continue their journey west.